and welcome to this week's dialect. Hello to everyone in Bristol and to our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 FM. Also to our listeners in Radio Verulam in St Albans, hello. And to all our friends in South America as well, we're told, and Colombia specifically, hello to you too. This week, we'll be talking to Keith and Jennifer Uttridge, who will talk us through the Travelling Light Magic Lantern Company's history. It's their own little company they've had going since 1984, and they'll be telling us about the history of the Magic Lantern. It's an authentic Victorian Edwardian form of entertainment using original slides and lanterns. We also speak to Alan Cooper, who is an expert on the history of Clevedon. Our roving reporter, Anthea Page, talks to Tyrrell Bacon, a veteran American Vietnam activist. Tony Gosling talks to the Bishop, Sean Manchester, about the Reverend Montague Summers and the supernatural. As always, we have the next instalment, part 31, apparently, of Treasure Island. My name is John Peters Coleman. It's my pleasure to welcome Mr. and Mrs. Keith and Jennifer Uttridge to the studio. Hello.
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 So tell me a little bit about the nature of magic lanterns, because this is your business as such. Is it an official business?
It's a hobby.
And
we've been doing it since 1984.
Okay, long time. And you travel around with it?
We travel all over the place, all over the southwest.
Okay. Yes. So what is a magic lantern, Jennifer?
Well, a magic lantern is basically a Victorian projector, but of course, being Victorian, it's made of brass. Quite a large
mahogany
box with two double barrels, so that we can dissolve pictures from one barrel to the other.
Okay.
Ours is powered by electricity, but when it was made in 1875, it was powered by oxygen and hydrogen. Quite an explosive mixture.
Okay, this is sounding very Heath Robinson. So when the power is going in, what does it actually do? Does it move a mechanism inside, or what happens in the magic lantern?
Are we talking about the original lighting or the modern day lighting? Because the modern day lighting is quartz halogen now,
okay.
Which is quite simple, isn't it? It's basically a bulb.
Yeah. So, I mean,
the oxygen and hydrogen was, in fact, limelight lantern.
Okay.
And I don't know whether you've heard of limelight, but limelight is a piece of carbide on a needle inside each chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And when the gas comes through and the flame is correctly lit, it lights the carbide, which produced a brilliant white light.
And if it's incorrectly
lit? If it's incorrectly lit, there was an explosion. And there were many injuries, including fatalities.
Okay, and this would obviously have been used in theatres, I guess, from the saying to be limelight.
Absolutely. Okay. The saying in the limelight, yes. The stage lighting at the front was limelight, yes.
Okay. So, I mean, what is the effect if you're sat in the audience? I mean, what do you see when you're witnessing a magic lantern show?
Well, we try to do an authentic Victorian magic lantern show, and so they will see stories of death and doom and disaster, of course, tales of temperance and warnings of demon drink. And these slides could be photographic, they could be hand-coloured, hand-painted, and they will also see some wonderful, wonderful moving slides.
OK, so people are looking at projection screen. What sort of material?
Calico, our large... Calico? We've got a 10x10...
10x10... calico screen.
10x10 foot.
Mm.
Yes.
Okay, and then a little way back from that, you've got your relatively, well, I suppose, small sheets or slides of material that you got your image on.
Yeah, most of the slides are 3¼ inches square.
Okay.
So you can imagine when they're hand painted, blown up to 10 feet, the painting is tremendous, that you could magnify it that much.
So how did you discover about magic lanterns? Where did you come across them in the 80s?
A long time ago, about 1982-3, we belonged to a society or a club, and the Christmas special was in fact a magic lantern show produced by an old friend of ours who sadly died about 3 years ago.
He's well known in the Bristol area.
He was very well known in the Bristol area. And
what was his name?
Philip Gallup.
Okay.
A very well-known lanternist, and he died 3 years ago. And what I saw that night, because Jennifer couldn't attend, she was not well that night, and I came home enthusing about this magic lantern show I'd seen, and I wanted a magic lantern and I wanted some slides. And that's how it started.
So we went to that and bought the biggest load of rubbish, beginners often do.
So what did you do, trawl around antique shops?
Yes, everywhere.
How long did it take you to actually find one?
We did quite
not
well.
Not long, actually. To find our first rubbishy one took a matter of weeks.
Oh, yes.
To find a nice one with discernment took a bit longer.
We did, in fact, advertise in the local paper, and this wonderful old gent who we became very good friends with contacted us and said he had a magic lantern and slides, and we could go and see them. And we did, in fact, buy our first mahogany-framed lantern from him and some wonderful moving slides. And that was within three, four, 5 months of...
What does a moving slide look like? So is it sort of early animation, pre-photography sort of thing?
Yes.
Yes.
How did that work? It's pre-cinema. I mean, it is actually archaeology of the cinema, because people were trying throughout the 19th century to try and get realistic movement on the screen.
Yeah.
So sometimes, well, you always have to have two pieces of glass, but sometimes you have one piece with fixed images, perhaps just a person's face with eyes staring at the audience, but the eyes are on a separate piece of glass, so as you pull the separate piece, the eyes move from side to side and appear to look around the room, and that's a very simple sliding movement.
That could look either quite charming or quite eerie.
Well,
it depends what the image is. There are lots of moving eye slides, and depending on the subject, some of them are quite eerie.
I'm assuming in more conservative Victorian times, the number of genres of shows you could go and see was fairly limited, or perhaps would I be wrong?
I think lantern shows in general, most people would have gone to see them really for amusement, but obviously with propaganda of the church or the missionary movement or the temperance movement trying to get their message across. But they would try to interest people by making them as entertaining as possible.
Okay, so live music accompaniment?
Some.
Not always.
No.
In fact, I very much doubt whether there was much in the Victorian times that we are doing now. I don't believe there would have been many people with a couple of singers and a dancer, which we have, and a regular pianist. We've had a regular pianist ever since we started doing shows. That's not something I think that most magic lantern shows in the Victorian era would have consisted of.
So, I mean, with the history of these magic lanterns, does that stretch back as far as, well, the history of glass slides and the ability to produce light? Were they only in the Victorian era, or was it invented sort of earlier than that?
No, one of the first recorded instances in this country was Samuel Pepys in his diary, 3 weeks before the fire of London in 1666, recorded buying a lantern and a telescope and some slides, and as he said, to make things appear on the wall very pretty.
That's amazing.
Yes, and then they were developed throughout the 18th century, and by the end of the 18th century you could have windmills with revolving sails, deer lapping up water, and all kinds of amazing effects that people, I think, didn't realise went on.
Would they have been quite expensive and only sort of relatively wealthy
horrendously
people?
There's a book I've been reading recently about charting the coast of Australia, and the captain took a lantern, which must have been a beautiful one, with wonderful slides, in 1846, which cost about £35, which was a huge, huge amount of money.
So was there any need for them to be that expensive? I mean, glass, mahogany and form of...
I think things would have been mass-produced, of course, and all the slides are totally hand-painted, often by very, very skilled miniaturists.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
So they were not a cheap and cheerful.
Now, one company in particular, Carpenter and Wesley of London, they produced the most wonderful hand-painted slides. They were stunning. And they were what was known as the Grand Tour. People went all over the world. Wealthy people went all over the world. These slides were produced as an advert, if you like, for those people wishing to go to various places. Incredibly good paintings. And even the ones that you see today, they haven't faded. They're just outstanding. So, yes, they were expensive slides.
Okay, so to what extent do you do your shows as per an original show? I mean, obviously, I don't know, some technological differences and maybe, I don't know, the pace might have been a bit slower, I imagine.
I think everyone who does shows, and there aren't that many of us, actually, anyone who does shows has their own interpretation. There are sets of slides relating to particular stories, which we do tend to keep to the original script. Certain ones, you can't find the script, so Jennifer's very good, and she does actually write verse for some of them. And I must say, they do work well, although it's not original.
Yeah.
So you can interpret it your own way, really. It doesn't really matter.
Also, I think in Victorian times, the pace was much, much slower. I think with television and other images, we're so used now to constantly changing pictures. We've got a set of slides that actually is 14 slides, and it says an hour in the Lake District. Now, you imagine sitting with a modern-day audience with just 14 images for a whole hour. I think they'd be out after 5 minutes. So, obviously, our pace is much, much slicker, and we get through a tremendous amount of material.
So it's sort of a weird cross between the cinema and an art gallery. You know, they would have expected you to sit there and appreciate the scene for some time.
Yes.
I think those particular slides would have been used actually in more of a lecture rather than a magic lantern show. There were a lot of lectures. And you could go there and just go there for a couple of hours and have a lecture on a certain subject. And then if you were lucky and you had a pianist and a singer there, they might sing a song to you at the end.
Okay.
Possibly.
Well, for this week, unfortunately, I think we've got to wrap up the interview, but I mean, we could go on talking for a long time. But do you have any shows coming up soon that people...
We do indeed, and we'd like to plug March the 24th, mm-hmm. Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Okay, and where?
In the Blake Hay Theatre in Weston-super-Mare.
Okay.
When we are reproducing the amazing skirt dance of 1896.
The amazing skirt dance of 1896. Yes. That sounds fantastic.
Shall we talk about that another time?
Yes, I'm sure we can get you back in to talk about that. Do you have an online presence where anybody can find out more?
Only on the Magic Lantern Society website, where we have our own page or pages.
Okay, yes. So if you just stick in the Magic Lantern Society, yes. into any search
engine, .org,
yes.
you
yes.
will find that straight away.
Yes.
Well, Mr. and Mrs. Utteridge, Keith and Jennifer, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Our next feature centres around the Vietnam War. Jimi Hendrix played at the Woodstock Festival, Upper State, New York, on August the 15th to the 18th, 1969. Hendrix and his band at the time were introduced to the festival goers by the MC, Chip Monk, as the Jim Hendrix Experience. They played a two-hour set, the longest of his career. Hendrix's psychedelic rendering of the US national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, occurred three-quarters of the way into their set. During this number, Hendrix used feedback and sustain on the guitar to recreate the sound of whales and falling rockets. Pundits quickly branded the song a political manifesto against the Vietnam War. You're now going to hear that piece as it was played at the Woodstock Festival, followed by an interview with Tyrell Bacon, a peace activist who campaigned against the Vietnam War in the 1960s in America.
Yeah! I'm in the busy foyer of the Old Vic Theatre. Hello.
Hello.
What's your name?
Terrell Bacon.
Can you tell me your story about Vietnam and being a hippie in America? Can you go back that far?
I think I can just about remember that. Although they do say if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there. I was, what was I, 21. I was a university student. I was active in the anti-war movement, Students for Democratic Action, Women for Peace, that sort of thing. And didn't seem to be doing a lot of good. I even had a visit from the FBI for refusing to pay the tax on my phone bill, which related to the war. A percentage was worked out.
Can you tell us about that visit?
Yeah, I'm sure you want me to. It's rather risque. Okay, I was in my purple loft room with my boyfriend. We had just finished making love when one of the other tenants came, knocked on the door and said, there's two men in suits downstairs to see you. So we laughed and said, send them up. And we didn't, I'm afraid, put any clothes on. So they interview me about the withholding of the tax on my telephone bill. I explained to them why. They made some notes and went away. They didn't even have a cup of coffee. Anyway, I was standing at a bus stop one day in all my hippie regalia, my peace badges and the rest of it.
Sorry, can I interrupt? Yes. Describe your hippie regalia.
Probably a long skirt, beads, jewellery, long hair, straight hair. Yeah, I suppose I was a fairly good-looking young woman, as we all were when we were young. Anyway, there was an elderly gentleman wearing military uniform with a fair bit of spaghetti on his shoulders and various emblems. And he came over to me and he said, you know, you people make me angry. America is wonderful. And if you don't love it, you should leave it. And I thought, by God, he's right. And so I did.
Why did you object to the Vietnam War?
Well, I object to all wars, but that one was particularly pernicious. And we daily saw evidence of what napalming was doing to men, women and children. And it was just unbearable to me. Of course, in those days, I didn't understand that hegemony was not simply the province of America.
So did you know anyone who fought in the Vietnam War? Were any of your friends involved?
My friends were doing things like faking suicide and writing I'm gay on their bodies when they went off to be conscripted, seen by medical doctors, taking overdoses in hospital car parks, anything, leaving the country, going to Canada, anything not to serve in that war.
Did you know anyone who was killed in the Vietnam War?
No, I didn't. But I did have an experience one day. A friend and I were hitchhiking from Berkeley, trying to get back into San Francisco. And a car pulled up, kid our age, blonde kid our age in a convertible with good music playing, offered us a lift, so we got in the back. And after a little while, he opened up the glove compartment, took out a couple of spliffs, lit them up, handed one back to us. And we thought, this is great. And then he said, this is my last day of freedom. I'm off to Vietnam tomorrow. I've signed up. And we just looked at each other. We'd just been on a demo the day before. We looked at each other, started to draw breath, my friend and I, and the kid said, I have to go. My best mate was killed 10 days ago. And there was absolutely nothing we could say to him because that was right for him to do. It was gutting, but that's how it was.
So you left America. What happened next?
Lived for a little while in Portugal, moved to Morocco, spent about a year there, moved to Spain, spent a year there, back and forth to England in between, and ended up here.
What made you settle here?
Well, I suppose I speak the language better than I spoke Spanish or Moroccan or Arabic. National health, I suppose. Yes, I'm an economic migrant.
So do you miss America?
No, I don't. But I don't feel particularly nationalistic in any sense. I think we're all citizens of one world. We need to wake up to that.
Do you think that's why you fit into England better? Because there's so many people who've come here in history from other cultures?
Maybe, but then America's supposed to be the melting pot. And in New York City, you will not find a native New Yorker driving a taxi, for example. It's extremely multicultural. So I don't think it's that. I think it's taken me decades, really, to understand English culture. I thought for at least 10 years that the class system was something to do with, you know, education classes. It's subtle. It's devious. By comparison, Americans are extremely naive, innocent, and appallingly stupid sometimes.
So are you still involved in the peace movement?
No, I'm... I'm chair of my university lecturers union at my university, so I suppose I'm still political in a sense, and, you know, Medicine Sans Frontier, that sort of thing. But no, I think it kind of doesn't matter where you plug into it, because we need everything from the, you know, the ladies selling tea cakes to the people occupying squares to the few politicians who have their heads screwed on. We need everything that everyone can do to try and work together to make this a better world.
So what lasting effect do you think the Vietnam War had on young people in America?
Well, I haven't been there since, I haven't lived there since the end of 1968, so I can't comment on that, but I would guess it's scarred the psyche rather deeply.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was the Star Spangled Banner, as performed by the Jim Hendrix Experience at Woodstock in 1969, followed by an interview with Tyrrell Bacon, a peace activist who campaigned against the Vietnam War in the 60s in America. If ever you have driven past or through a rather unassuming Clevedon, you may well like to know that there is a great history to this place, and I have an expert on the history of Clevedon with me now, Alan Cooper. Hello.
Hello.
How long have you been living in Clevedon?
Since 1983, but I lived in Yatton, which is 5 miles further on than Clevedon, since 1965.
So what brought you to Clevedon? How old were you?
Well, work, really.
And what do you particularly like about Clevedon?
It's a lovely town. It's steeped in history, and it's your typical Victorian town. A great deal of really excellent Victorian buildings still standing.
Yeah.
And everywhere you go in Clevedon, you can see the history.
Okay.
Especially if you look up. You must look up, because you see signs and embellishments that the Victorians loved to put on their buildings, even humble villas, you know, have got these ornate barge boards on the edge of the roofs, and really something to see.
Clevedon has its own heritage centre.
Yes, it does indeed.
How long has that been open?
Back in the 70s, it was founded, among other people, by Victor Cox, who was a monumental mason and sculptor who lived in Clevedon.
Okay.
And he indeed also started the Curzon Cinema. We've still got a cinema in Clevedon.
No way, that's quite rare to have
yes,
cinema in a small town like that.
It's 100 years old this year.
Okay, well, there's a chance to celebrate. Now, you've been doing some research yourself in recent times about Clevedon. How far back does your research
stretch?
Well, I've
gone right back to the Stone Age, moving in to the Bronze Age and then the Iron Age.
Okay.
And there are signs of quite a few settlements around Clevedon, notably on Court Hill or Cadbury Camp. And there was a promontory fort on Wayne's Hill.
Okay. A lot of places are based around rivers or fords, or, I mean, what is there in Clevedon that's meant the town that's been there?
There is one river, the Landio, which goes out and enters the sea at what we call the Pill, which is below Wayne's Hill. Clevedon is on the estuary of the River Severn.
Okay.
Which has the second highest tidal range in the world. And this very high tidal range, coupled with quite a few low-lying bits of land, mean that back in the days before sea defences, the sea probably came in quite a long way inland.
Okay, so is there any one particular industry that's lent itself to developing?
Well, yes, two companies that became one, actually. A company called Engineering Productions were very active during the Second World War, and after the war, it started making components for the auto industry.
Okay.
And a little bit later on, that was bought out by a company called Cam Gears, and they were in the business of making automobile parts, particularly steering systems.
So, I mean, obviously the car industry has since died off. So, I mean, what is Clevedon like?
What used to be the main factory is now Tesco's.
Tesco. So what sort of a place is Clevedon like to live in now?
As I said, there's not a lot of industry, so most of the people that live in the town probably have to commute to Weston and Bristol. But
do you think that lends a certain hollowness to towns these days?
I don't think so. Clevedon is a very active town. It's got five drama-related societies.
That's a lot for a small town.
Yes, it is. The Clevedon Players, the Clevedon Light Opera, Clevedon Comedy Club, what they call GWITS, which is the Great Western Youth Theatre, and the Gilbert and Sullivan Society.
Okay. So, I mean, there's quite a creative atmosphere in Clevedon.
Yes, yes. And Clevedon Players, which I'm a member of, they produce three productions a year.
Do you get many artists living in Clevedon?
Yes, there are quite a few. Terry Bevan is a particular one that comes to mind. And several of them, they have an art show in Clevedon every year, which is very well attended.
What sort of place is it, do you think, in terms of people? Some places, particularly outlying towns, find that their population ages because young people can't really afford to buy housing there and move to different places.
The mix, I think, is a very good one. In 2001 census, the population of Clevedon was 21,957. But if you think that in 1801, the population of Clevedon was 334, you know, the town has really grown up in the last 200 years, if you like.
Yeah. So what led to such huge population growth for the place?
Well, certainly the general exodus of the people with more money, if you like, came to Clevedon because the air was good. Originally, the sea bathing was a draw. Then the railway came.
So it's all quite a leisure town for the well-to-do, perhaps, own businesses in Bristol.
Yeah, a lot of very rich merchants chose Clevedon to come and settle.
How does the tourism industry for Clevedon Pier compare to Weston-super-Mare as a classic Victorian seaside town?
Well, Clevedon Pier is a truly remarkable pier in as much as it was built in 1869 and has weathered the storms, which Clevedon is quite well known for.
Lastly, I guess I better start wrapping up, but tell me a little bit about when and where people can go if they want to visit Clevedon Heritage Centre.
So, well, it's just up from the pier, number 4 Beach Road.
Okay.
In the winter time, it closes about 4 o'clock, so from 10 till 4 every day except Mondays. It's an excellent place to go if you want to learn about all types of history. We show videos as well as other static displays showing the gradual development of Clevedon from Stone Age and Iron Age settlement to the sort of town it is today.
Brilliant. Well, Alan Cooper, thank you very much for coming in, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
In previous episodes of Dialects, you will have noticed that we had pieces on Montagu Summers. Tony has read out pieces written by him about the supernatural. So, Montagu Summers, he was born in 1880, for those of you who weren't listening previously, the son of Augustus William Summers, a Clifton Justice of the Peace and banker. He was educated at Clifton College and went on to be ordained as a Church of England deacon, working as a curate in Bath and Bitton. He went on to become a Catholic, subsequently leaving the Roman Catholic Church and being ordained as an independent Catholic priest. He was fascinated by the supernatural, writing on the subject as well as producing studies of Gothic fiction and performing exorcisms. Around the time of Montagu Summers' death, at the age of 68 in 1948, the Times of London wrote that he was in every way a character, and in some sort a throwback to the Middle Ages. A bishop who today follows his independent Catholic tradition dedicated his best-selling book, The Highgate Vampire, to Montagu Summers. Dalek's Tone Gosling asked the Right Reverend Bishop Sean Manchester about similarities between his own journey of faith and that of Bristol's Edwardian eccentric, whose medallion against vampires, as we heard last week, he is set to inherit.
I'm the Right Reverend Sean Manchester, an autocephalous bishop in the One Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, who is best known for carrying out exorcisms. People do know me as best as the composite person I am, and principally through my public persona, which is largely television and film. I'm exactly the sort of bishop that people were used to for millennia until the liberal, non-believing type emerged in the largely in the nonconformist and Anglican churches, where you had a position in the 90s, as recorded in the Times newspaper, where at least 90 bishops in the Church of England did not believe in the existence of God. Like Montagu Summers, of whom few had heard anything until recent decades, I began in the Church of England, chiefly as a choir boy and the head of a boys' church, and converted to Roman Catholicism under Pope Pius XII, so pre-Vatican II, when things were still very traditional, and became disenchanted when they ceased to hold fast to the ways that had gone prior for centuries and threw the baby up with the bathwater as the signposts fell down. My spiritual odyssey is quite involved, but it led eventually to me entering holy orders in an autocephalous Catholic jurisdiction, which is not under the universal jurisdiction of the Pope.
Can you just tell us what this word autocephalous means?
It means not under the supervision of an organization such as the Vatican.
And would you compare your progress through the churches, various churches, to Montagu?
It's very similar, in so much as Montagu Summers began in the Church of England. He identified very much with the Roman Catholic Church, probably more than I do. I mean, he was ultramontane. I mean, he was exceptionally Catholic. But again, although he was diaconated in the Roman Church, as he had been also in the Church of England, his priestly orders were in the Old Catholic Church in its traditional manifestation.
Many people in Bristol have not even heard of Montagu Summers, even though he lived in Clifton. So can you tell us who he was?
The Right Reverend Alphonsus Joseph Mary Augustus Montagu Summers. Fascinating character, without whom vampirological and indeed demonological research would have been very much the poorer. He was certainly a vampirologist of what some have believed to be, though not I, in questionable orders. His orders, as far as I'm concerned, were absolutely legitimate and valid. Indeed, I know what his apostolic succession is, and that he was consecrated variously. For example, in March 1946, he was appointed nuncio for Great Britain. He'd been consecrated for the Order of Corporate Reunion in June 1927 by Bishop Dominic Albert Godwin. But very few, I don't think any biographers that I'm aware of or writers on some seem to be aware of these facts. Maybe it's because they're outside the ecclesiastical perspective. But I share many similarities to Summers' career insofar as I began in Anglicanism, converted to Roman Catholicism, and ended up, as did Summers, in an independent Catholic jurisdiction to hang on to the old traditions. I mean, he was undoubtedly, as some have described myself, a throwback to an earlier age. an unreconstructed Jacobite, one might say, longed for the restoration of Catholic England.
Now, you may say that, but, I mean, what's the problem with the Protestant Church? I mean, many people believe that the whole idea of the Pope being almost like God's representative on earth, the infallibility, this kind of thing, was what Protestants were overthrowing. So wasn't that actually a positive move?
Moving away from Somers for the moment, if you go back to Henry VIII and that era, they regarded themselves as Catholics. They broke away from Rome and the universal jurisdiction of the Pope, but they still regarded themselves very much as Catholics. Indeed, traditional Anglicans today regard themselves as Catholics. They describe themselves as not Roman, but English Catholics. This is what is misunderstood by so many people, quite apart from the fact that there are many Catholic churches apart from the Roman Catholic Church. There's Eastern Catholic. I mean, if you were in Iraq, for example, you'd be in the Chaldean Catholic Church, which, as it happens, is in full communion with Rome, but is independent of Rome. And there are many other Eastern Catholic churches.
Do you think it's fair to compare you and Monty in that both of you were aware that the traditional Church of England was not really believing in Christ? Because that's quite a strong challenge to make.
Well, my experience with the Church of England, which in my early years was quite intimate, found most answers from the minister being, well, it's fine, you can believe that if you want, or you don't have to believe it if you don't want. And I found this wishy-washy attitude to principal matters of doctrine unacceptable. I mean, Somers is quite explicit, as am I, that the matters in Holy Scripture, in doctrine, are not negotiable. They're not up for discussion. You can reject them, of course, but you cannot meddle with them and say, I'll take that but not that, and I don't like the sound of that. Either it is a part of Holy Writ and what was decided upon by the faithful, the early church, the church fathers, and the ecumenical councils. Either it is so or it is not.
But now, I mean, the Church of England would argue that what they're doing is they're putting a little bit of spin on the Bible in order to really make Christianity more appealing to people.
Well, I mean, Christianity is not a popularity club, and it is not supposed to be appealing to people. People are supposed to search and find the truth, and Christianity proffers the truth. I believe it's scripturally the case that it will always be a minority, and I would rather have a small church of true believers than a vast monolithic organization of heretics and those that believe whatever they want to believe. I mean, there are groups within the various churches like the Church of England who clearly don't believe in anything whatsoever. Everything's explained away by psychology, and I mean, I can't understand why they become ordained in the first place. Not that their ordinations are regarded as valid by Roman and Eastern churches, but I mean, the fact is that they'd be better doing social work or something of that sort, because faith doesn't seem to enter into it. And those genuine Christians who are in the priesthood and the laity of the, for example, Anglican Church, who hold fast to the true doctrines, they regard themselves very much as Catholics, not Roman, but they do regard themselves as Catholics.
That was the Right Reverend Sean Manchester, thank you very much to him, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. The Right Reverend Montague Somers was writing and publishing from his home in Clifton between the First and Second World Wars, and we'll hear more about one of Bristol's most eccentric priests next week. Next up, another gripping instalment of Treasure Island, as read ever by the trusty seafarer Malcolm Grieve. This is Chapter 31, The First Half.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 6, Captain Silver. Chapter 31, The Treasure Hunt. Flint's Pointer. Jim, said Silver when we were alone, if I saved your life, you saved mine, and I'll not forget it. I seen the doctor waving you to run for it, with the tail of my eye I did, and I seen you say no, as plain as hearing. Jim, that's one to you. This is the first glint of hope I had since the attack failed, and I owe it to you. And now, Jim, we're to go in for this here treasure hunting, with sealed orders too, and I don't like it. And you and me must stick close, back to back like, and we'll save our necks, in spite of fate and fortune. Just then a man hailed us from the fire that breakfast was ready, and we were soon seated here and there about the sand over biscuit and fried junk. They had lit a fire fit to roast an ox, and it was now grown so hot that they could only approach it from the windward, and even there not without precaution. In the same wasteful spirit, they had cooked, I suppose, 3 times more than we could eat, and one of them with an empty laugh threw what was left into the fire, which blazed and roared again over this unusual fuel. I never in my life saw men so careless of the morrow. Hand to mouth is the only word that can describe their way of doing, and what with wasted food and sleeping sentries, though they were bold enough for a brush and be done with it, I could see their entire unfitness for anything like a prolonged campaign. Even Silver, eating away with Captain Flint upon his shoulder, had not a word of blame for their recklessness. And this the more surprised me, for I thought he had never shown himself so cunning as he did then. "Aye, mates," said he, "it's lucky you have barbecue to think for you with this here head. I got what I wanted, I did. Sure enough, they have the ship. Where they have it, I don't know yet. But once we hit the treasure, we'll have to jump about and find it. And then, mates, us that has the boats, I reckon, has the upper hand." Thus he kept running on with his mouth full of the hot bacon. Thus he restored their hope and confidence, and I more than suspect, repaired his own at the same time. "As for hostage," he continued, "that's his last talk, I guess, with them he loves so dear. I've got my piece of news, and thankee to him for that. But it's over and done. I'll take him in a line when we go treasure hunting, for we'll keep him like so much gold. In case of accidents, you mark. And in the meantime, once we got the ship and treasure both, and off to sea like jolly companions, why then, we'll talk Mr. Hawkins over, we will, and we'll give him his share, to be sure, for all his kindness." It was no wonder the men were in a good humour now. For my part, I was horribly cast down. Should the scheme he had now sketched prove feasible, Silver, already doubly a traitor, would not hesitate to adopt it. He still had a foot in either camp, and there was no doubt he would prefer wealth and freedom with the pirates to a bare escape from hanging, which was the best he had to hope for on our side. Nay, and even if things so fell out that he was forced to keep his faith with Dr. Livesey, even then what danger lay before us? What a moment that would be when the suspicions of his followers turned to certainty, and he and I should have to fight for dear life, he a cripple, and I a boy, against 5 strong and active seamen. Add to this double apprehension the mystery that still hung over the behaviour of my friends, their unexplained desertion of the stockade, their inexplicable cession of the chart, or harder still to understand, the doctor's last warning to Silver: "Look out for squalls when you find it." And you will readily believe how little taste I had for my breakfast, and with how uneasy a heart I set forth behind my captors on the quest for treasure. We made a curious figure had anyone been there to see us, all in soiled sailor clothes, and all but me armed to the teeth. Silver had 2 guns slung about him, one before and one behind, besides the great cutlass at his waist and a pistol in each pocket of his square-tailed coat. To complete his strange appearance, Captain Flint sat perched on his shoulder and gabbled odds and ends of purposeless sea talk. I had a line about my waist and followed obediently after the sea cook, who held the loose end of the rope, now in his free hand, now between his powerful teeth. For all the world, I was led like a dancing bear. The other men were variously burthened, some carrying picks and shovels, for they had been the very first necessary they had brought ashore from the Hispaniola. Others laden with pork, bread and brandy for the midday meal. All the stores, I observed, came from our stock, and I could see the truth of Silver's words the night before. Had he not struck a bargain with the doctor, he and his mutineers, deserted by the ship, must have been driven to subsisting on clear water and the proceeds of their hunting. Water would have been little to their taste. A sailor is not usually a good shot, and besides all that, when they were so short of eatables, it was not likely they would be very flush of powder. Well, thus equipped, we all set out, even the fellow with the broken head, who should certainly have kept in shadow, and straggled one after another to the beach where the two gigs awaited us. Even these bore trace of the drunken folly of the pirates, one in a broken thwart, and both in their muddied and unbaled condition. Both were to be carried along with us for the sake of safety. And so, with our numbers divided up between them, we set forth upon the bosom of the anchorage.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Gree for reading Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Eagle-eared listeners will remember we had a gentleman on called Cameron Stewart, whose surname is spelled as in Rod Stewart, not as in the monarchical Stewart. And he was the grandson of a officer in the First World War who wrote diaries about his experiences, which he then compiled, and together with a historian who wrote various interluding passages explaining the context, released these diaries as a publishable book called A Very Unimportant Officer. But while he was in, we got him to read out a little bit that he had selected himself, a particularly interesting snippet from the diaries that gave us a flavour of what his grandfather's diaries were like, and this is him reading.
I'll just say that this was actually the piece that when I picked it up, I was most struck by, and I thought I've got to do something with it. It's during the second attack on the Hindenburg line. When I was within about 5 yards of the trench, I saw a machine gun poke its nose over the parapet 2 or 3 yards to my left front, so I moved obliquely towards it. I then saw the tin helmet of one of the machine gunners. At this helmet I fired with my revolver, and do not think I can have missed. I then had a shot at a man who appeared the other side of the gun. I think I got him also. And then a head and neck appeared where the first man had been, and I had my third shot. Then some blighter in the trench just opposite me threw a stick bomb at us, or me. It exploded just by my feet. He was a sitter, and I got him also with my revolver. By this time, things were happening a bit too rapidly to remain clear in my memory, but there was one young chap I remember very clearly shooting in the back as he was running away, but I forget whether I got him with a revolver or a rifle. My next recollection is that I had no more shots left in my revolver and was still not yet in the trench. As I had no intention of getting into the trench unarmed, I proceeded to unsling the rifle with fixed bayonet I had over my shoulder. I should have mentioned that after my third or fourth shot, I found that the bowl of my pipe and the smoke from it was obscuring my line of vision, as I was firing slightly downwards all the time. Much to my annoyance, I had to put my pipe in my pocket, alight as it was. It was lucky that it did not burn my jacket. Just as I got my rifle working, I saw a man in the trench, calmly kneeling down and taking careful aim at me. At the moment I saw him, he fired, but in some miraculous way, he missed. It seems almost incredible that he should have missed at such close range. He was certainly not more than 6 yards away. Anyway, I did not miss him.
That's absolutely extraordinary. Like, not only does it draw you in with all of this, then he's in the middle of smoking a pipe while he's doing it.
I know. I know. It is extraordinary. You got the MC for that.
Thank you very much to Cameron Stewart. And the book is called A Very Unimportant Officer, and it's available from all good bookshops now. You may have heard in the news recently that Nick Clegg observed that more companies should be like John Lewis. Well, that's quite a curious subject, and Anthea Page knew a gentleman who worked for John Lewis, so we invited him in. Mr. Graham Luff, hello.
Hello.
So when did you work for John Lewis?
I worked for John Lewis for about 15 years.
Okay.
From about the mid-90s, and I retired from there just over a year ago.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about what you think about Nick Clegg's remarks. Should more companies be like John Lewis?
Well, John Lewis is often mentioned in the news for a variety of reasons. It's a good guide to seeing how the retail market is going, because if John Lewis is doing particularly badly, then the whole retail market is doing badly. It happens to be doing quite well at the moment in the face of some big retailers like Tesco not doing so particularly well. The reasons for that are curious. One of the reasons I think that John Lewis at the moment is doing so well is that they got into the online retail market quite early. And if you look at the John Lewis sales, their online sales are staggeringly good. I was there when they first mooted that they would go into online retailing, and they thought within about 3 or 4 years the online business would be taking about the same as what the Oxford Street branch of John Lewis takes, which is the biggest branch in London. And I think within 3 years it was taking twice what the Oxford Street branch was doing.
Okay. So does it get compared a lot? I mean, the way that John Lewis's business model practices is obviously very different from Marks & Spencer's. How has Marks & Spencer's been doing relative to...
Sort of not terribly good. Their figures for Christmas were not wonderful, and I think their share price went down as a result. Of course, the thing about John Lewis is that there are no shares in John Lewis that you can buy.
Okay. And this brings us to the nub of the issue. What do you think Nick Clegg meant when he said that more businesses should be like John Lewis?
Well, the model of John Lewis is fairly unique. I don't think it's totally unique. I don't think you can have things that are fairly unique, but it's quite unusual in that when John Speed and Lewis, who's founder of the company, set up a number of shops, he got to a point where he thought, this is not right for me to take all the profits for this company. I'll create what is called a partnership. So everyone that works in the company has a part ownership of that company. And obviously the company's expanded and Waitrose became part of John Lewis at some point. So it's now quite a large company, certainly not as big as Debenhams or Marks & Spencer's, but it's quite a sizable company. But still, everyone that works in either John Lewis or Waitrose is referred to as a partner, not as an employee. And we all have voting rights on how the company is run.
Now, did that work for you as an employee? What did you enjoy about working at John Lewis?
What was good about it was that you weren't sort of working somewhere and all decisions were just made way above your head and you just had to implement them whether you liked it or not. Certainly in the department store division, all the branches had what was called a branch forum, which was made up of representatives from all parts of the shop. And there were really important discussions with the managing director about all sorts of issues. And then at a higher level, there were committees working in head office that would work alongside the senior management. And it wasn't sort of, we pay lip service to these people and they can say what they like, but we'll just do what we want to do.
Yeah.
No, it was a real democracy.
Was that an efficient way of making decisions? Or does that risk turning into a giant talking shop?
It does have that risk, and it has to be controlled, because in any organisation you'll get people that like the sound of their own voice and will just talk and talk and talk and not make any decisions.
Yeah.
So it's a risk that you take. But if you can make it work, and John Lewis over the years has made it work pretty well, you can get a real democracy at work where people who work there really feel they're part of the company rather than just an employee of the company.
Do you think more businesses should be like John Lewis then? Do you think Nick Clegg is right?
Some companies would say, oh, you know, we like John Lewis, we give our employees shares in the company. That's not real democracy. There's loads of companies that do that, but they don't operate like John Lewis. It's a whole culture that operates at John Lewis, where everybody who works for it feels that they're very much part of it and can, if they want to, take a very active part in the management of that company. Now, just issuing shares to employees won't give them the power to actually decide important issues to do with the company. So it means a whole culture change if companies want to become more like John Lewis.
So do you think you perhaps should have rephrased what you said slightly in terms of what he's trying to say? Perhaps it's not so much businesses should be more like John Lewis, but people just simply need to be more actively involved and feel like they're a part of what's actually going on rather than just being dictated to.
Yes, I mean, it's one of those things where a lot of companies have to deal with trade unions. There are no trade unions in John Lewis because it's felt that there isn't any need for a trade union because all the staff take an active role in the running of the company. Now, other businesses would say, well, we have trade unions and we deal with them, and those are the people that we negotiate with. But it's not that sort of culture at John Lewis.
But it's perhaps something that's perhaps worth exploring. So Nick Clegg is not off the mark.
No, he's not completely off the mark. And there's, I know, you know, a number of people come to John Lewis and say, tell us how, you know, your model works, because we'd like to try something like that in our company. But it does mean quite a shift in culture. But if it works, you get everybody in the company really behind that company, because it's their company. If the company does badly, you do badly. Whereas if you work for some other big retailers, well, you know, I come in, I do my hours, I take my money, I go home. And whether it fails,
okay,
or...
And that's it. Okay, well, I mean, on that note, Graham Luff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's all from Dialect this week. Thank you very much to our studio guests. We had Keith Uttridge and his wife Jennifer Uttridge discussing magic lanterns. Thank you also to Alan Cooper for discussing the history of Clevedon. Thank you also to Cameron Stewart. Our features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. And we also had another episode of Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve from Swindon. The studio engineer was Michael Noyce. Thank you also to Graham Luff, who popped in at the last minute to discuss John Lewis with us. The producer was Michaela Dennis, through the mind control of John Peters Coleman and Michael Noyce. If you would like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can find us on dialectradio.co.uk and, of course, Bristol Community Radio website, bcfm.org.uk. So it's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman, and we'll see you next week.